Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Fulham Road in Chelsea, SW10. A few streets south of the beating of Gunter Padola. A short walk west of the jealousy of Jane Andrews. Barely a quick trip from the bubbling drum of John George Haig. And a short trot east of the lies of Ronald True. Coming soon to Murder Mile. At 369 Fulham Road, on the site of the St George's Workhouse, stands Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. A small but vital facility, with a world-renowned burns unit, a children's hospital. And if you're a man who on a Friday night slipped on a cucumber while making a salad in the nude, they'll sort that too. In 1876, before the NHS was founded, as a middle ground between the workhouse and the infirmary, the Westminster Institute was built to provide beds, meals and free healthcare for 13,000 sick and impoverished men who had no homes, no work and no families, in return for an honest day's work. Like a prison, the inmates did what they could to relieve the boredom, by sneaking in contraband, by pinching treats from the mess hall, by blagging an extra cup of tea when the warders weren't watching. And through George Hamblin, the Institute's secret bookie, you could bet on a horse for a penny. As just a little bit of fun for the regulars who liked to have a flutter, at best he made a small profit off the £4 a day he placed on the day's races. And although he barely made enough to have a fun night out with a lady, the little stash of coins would prove so tempting for a fellow inmate that they'd kill him for it. But why? My name is Michael. I'm your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 244. No Fixed Abode. George Hamblin was typical of the Institute's long-term inmates. He wasn't there because of a crime he'd committed, but because life had been unkind to him. Alan George Hamblin was born in 1866 in Lambeth, South London. Having never married or had kids, and with him and his only next of kin, his brother, having not spoken in a decade. Little is known about his life, except that he was a driver until he was hospitalised owing to heart issues and chronic asthma. Beginning as a day inmate in 1921, growing ever sicker and paler as his bronchitis ravaged his battered lungs, by 1934, George had become one of Westminster Institute's longest-serving residents. as a thin man who a stiff breeze could easily blow over. On the outside, he was a nobody. But on the inside, 49-year-old George had the privileged position of being valet to the Labour superintendent. With light duties, he cleaned his boss's rooms, he served his meals, and he ironed his uniform in return for a less strenuous day befitting a man of his frailty. As he walked the dark, echoey halls with a stoop. Being a familiar face and a trusted lag who could get any inmate whatever they wanted for a price. Wherever George went, from the mess hall in Block B, his bunk in bed 3 of B63, or the storeroom in B77, which everyone nicknamed the dugout, his slow and steady shuffle was heard, accompanied by his raspy wheezing cough, which he soothed with yet another rolly of tobacco from his daily ration. This was his life, simple and inoffensive. As this ailing and tragically forgotten man would make his days a little bit better by placing small bets for his pals, by trading goods for simple pleasures, and by October 1934, the highlight of his week was finding a French 25 centime coin, which he kept in his wallet. His friend was a recent inmate called George Harvey, who everyone called Jim. Born in Wandsworth in 1908, 27-year-old George Frederick Harvey was an ex-chef of no fixed abode. At least, that's what he would tell the police. Only little of that was true. Born in Balham, his real name was Charles Malcolm Lake Schoenberg, one of six siblings to Thomas of German heritage and Florence of French, who were raised in post-World War I Britain on a respectable middle-class street. As a stockily built man who had grown to a strapping 6'2", Jim's health was cursed from the day he was born by being burdened by sickness, disability, and chronic alcoholism in the family. As a baby, he was plagued with infantile convulsions, and having left home when he was just 8 years old, he rarely returned. Sparsely educated, age 17, he joined the Merchant Navy as a cook. But having contracted malaria, in 1926, aged just 19, this large imposing brute was discharged from service on account of his breathlessness. Being unmarried, homeless, and jobless, after 2.5 years in prison for stealing a few coins, a watch, and a set of earrings for a lady as a present, in 1932, age 25, the large lumbering form of Jim entered the infirmary to be treated for his asthma, which left him unable to do even the simplest of tasks. And also plagued by a bad heart, this wheezing hulk couldn't run a few steps without sweating or fainting. Like George, the Westminster Institution had become his home. But as much as he would hate it, there were ways to make it more bearable. Life inside was about little victories. Unlike a workhouse, as the beds were for men who were too sick to be booted out, but not sick enough to stay in the infirmary, the Institute wasn't a bad place. You couldn't leave without permission, but if you did, they wouldn't alert the police to watch the ports, as knowing that these men had nothing else, most of them returned and were only punished by having their privileges cut. Inside, you wore the uniform of an inmate, a blue-striped shirt and trousers. But if you were granted a day pass to go outside to earn a day's money, or even to visit your family, you got your own clothes back. Which is why Harry Pocock, the superintendent, knew about these little scams, but he did nothing about them. If the inmates were selling drugs, hard liquor or blades, he clamped down on those harshly. But he'd always turn a blind eye to these innocent little trades for a few pennies, which made the men feel normal. Jim's racket was selling cups of tea. As with every inmate rationed to just 3 cups of rather weak dribble, which had once been waved near a leaf. For just 1p, he could slip you a hot mug of a nice strong brew. Not alcohol, not methylated spirit, just tea, which we all know is the fuel which powers Britain. George's racket was horse racing, and his routine was always the same. Before breakfast, George went around B Block with the newspaper, informing the inmates of the races. The odds were calculated using a ready reckoner book which he kept in his jacket. Each inmate was handed a betting slip. At 4:30 p.m, George's messenger, William Richardson, popped out to purchase an evening paper which had that day's race results. And with the bell for B Block ringing at 5 p.m. sharp, each winner was told of their score over the meal in the mess hall, with the winnings collected from the dugout. Everyone knew about the dugout. Room B77 was little more than a storeroom, whereas Harry Pocock's valet, George, would wash his plates, iron his uniform, and given a key, it was the perfect place to stash the cash, which he received from the inmates in pennies, tuppences, occasionally a sixpence, and most recently, a postal order. It wasn't much of a room, barely 13 feet by 8 feet, with a chair, 3 low tables, an electric light, a bed for if George got sleepy, and the sideboard decorated with all manner of mucky pictures of sexy ladies. And with this being the 1930s, if you were really lucky, you may get a chance to perv over an ankle. Whoa. As pals, one of the few inmates who George let into the room was Jim. But just as his real name was Charles, Jim's motive wasn't to chat. It began, it is assumed, a few days before when Jim sent a letter to a girl he was fond of, Clara Barnes. He wrote,
"Dear Miss Barnes, I should like to see you Saturday. If you're around near the Regal Marble Arch at about 8 o'clock, we could get in a show or something. You will know me. Tall fellow. You saw me on Monday a while back. Hope all okay. See you soon. Frederick."
Even though everyone knew him as Jim. Whereas, George's lady friend, a widow called Mrs. Eva Clark, later mentioned to the police. He said a big fellow was blackmailing him. Sometimes afterwards, he received a ragged piece of paper on which was written, "Yes, 13, yes." She didn't know what it meant, and George never told her who the big fellow was. But I think it's safe to guess. Thursday the 25th of October 1934 was as routine as any other day. From 5 a.m. to 7 a.m., Jim served 40 cups of strong tea making himself roughly £90 today. As before breakfast, George chatted to the bettors about the races. But at 9 a.m, as a key piece of premeditation, Jim asked the assistant master for permission to leave the institute at 5 p.m. Being an unusual request, as none of the inmates were allowed to have nighttime jobs, this was denied, meaning he couldn't obtain a leave slip or his own clothes. During the day, William the messenger collected the inmates' coins, totalling £4.03 on 137 bets as noted in the Ready Reckoner, as well as a postal order from Walter Blanchett for a horse called Argyle. At 4:30 p.m, knocking on the locked door of the dugout, William handed the evening paper to George, who was slumped over the table calculating the winnings. As Jim towered over him, beside the door. As usual, William only stayed for a minute. The door was locked behind him, and he saw nothing suspicious. At 5 p.m. precisely, the dinner bell rang, and the inmates dashed to the mess hall, leaving B block empty. Nobody heard anything. Not a shout, not a cry, not a scream. But having done the unthinkable, Jim needed to flee. His escape wasn't really a master plan, as with the institution's security being so lax, at 5:15 p.m, the hulking bulk easily made his way out. Having already swiped a day slip from an unattended desk, he changed into his own clothes with his bloody shirt hidden under his grey suit. He handed in his uniform, and although he was very agitated and sweating profusely, he tottered out before anyone could quiz him. At that same moment, at 5:15 p.m, William the messenger knocked on the door of the dugout. But as George was prone to taking a little nap after dinner, getting no reply, he wasn't all that worried. And although later, a nightcap discovered that both George Hamblin and Jim Harvey were missing from their beds, the police weren't alerted and no search party was sent for. As like on most nights, as many as 6 men had gone AWOL. Only one hadn't left, and the other would never return. At a little after 5:30 p.m, a taxi pulled up out of 2 Colville houses in Bayswater, the home of Miss Clara Barnes, a local prostitute, who Jim was sweet on. Perspiring like the Niagara Falls of sweat, she was shocked to see him. Not because his face was as red as a baboon's backside, but because she wasn't expecting him for 2 more days. But with his bad heart and his chronic asthma explaining his look, he confessed,
"I was running a betting book, and I lost a lot of money,"
which more than explained his frayed nerves. Clara was why he'd stolen the money, to spend a night with a girl who he truly loved, having only met her once. And yet the romantic date he had dreamed of would be ruined by the horror of what he had done. That night, before anyone in the institution was even aware that he was missing. At 7 p.m, Clara and Jim hopped in a taxi to the Blue Hall Cinema on Edgware Road. Exiting the cab, he was as twitchy as an addict going through withdrawal, as every voice, bark or siren he heard spooked him. Paying 2 shillings for seats in the empty upper circle. Within minutes of being seated, Jim nervously stammered,
"I'm sorry, I've got to go to the toilet."
Jim knew that it wouldn't take a detective to find George's body, to blame him for the death, to realise the money was missing, and to see that the murder weapon was still on the table where he had left it. Having stashed the bloody shirt behind the toilet, he knocked up a ceiling panel and hid the ready reckoners and the tobacco pouch. And although he wanted to go into hiding, the purpose of the crime was to go on a date with Clara. So having ditched the film, they went to a pub where he sunk a few double whiskies with a Guinness chaser. And although Clara wanted to have fun, Jim couldn't. That night, they didn't have sex, as with his nerves shot, he couldn't manage it. Sitting upright in bed, smoking and muttering, although Jim put on 2 shirts as he was shivering, he couldn't stop shaking. Holding George's wallet, it contained all that was left from the heist. 4 shillings and sixpence, which he gave to Clara, leaving him with just a postal order, a French 25 centime coin, and the key to the dugout. And that was it. It should have been a wild night of thrills. But with a man lying dead, it was all for nothing. The next morning, at 5 a.m, the usual 40 men who paid a penny for a strong cup of tea were awoken to nothing from Jim. At 7 a.m, no one heard that familiar shuffle as George normally went from bed to bed with a paper taking bets. At 7:15 a.m, with both men missing, Frederick Thomas, the labour master, grabbed the spare key to the dugout, where it was known that George often kept, and he unlocked the door. With the light still on, although it was bright enough to see,
"When I entered, I slipped,"
as all around his feet was blood. The room was small, but so violent were the blows that blood splattered 4 feet off the ground, up the walls, onto parts of the ceiling, and even speckling the mucky nudes in a red dripping goo. With the door having been locked, the police knew that the killer had let themselves out. And yet, only a few men were ever let in. Arriving on site, and seeing the position of the body and the concentration of the blood spatter, Home Office pathologist Sir Bernard Spilsbury deduced that the attack had occurred as George was slumped over a low table, tallying the betting slips, which were now scattered across the floor, using his ready reckoner, which was missing, as was the pot of winnings, which usually totaled £4 to £5 in assorted coins. Many items had vanished, like the tobacco pouch, his wallet, and the door key. And with the killer having rifled his pockets, with blood-stained hands as the sticky insides were sticking out, There was no denying that this was a robbery. But was it also a personal attack, as the level of violence would suggest? George hadn't been a well man. A small, frail weakling who wheezed when he breathed. And as Sir Bernard would state,
the first blow was enough to render him senseless.
But this attack was brutal and frenzied. On the table, the weapon sat, sopping wet and unnervingly sticky. It was hard to tell what it was, having been wrapped in a brown Hessian sack and tied with tape. So when his victim's juices rode up the handle with every blow, his killer's hand didn't slip. But having snapped into two, owing to the force that was used, at 2 feet long and 2 kilos in weight, George had been killed with a lump hammer used for breaking rocks. The autopsy confirmed.
He was struck while slumped over the table and held there while the other blows were delivered.
In total, he was hit 9 times with a hammer across the back of the head. The first had rendered him semi-conscious. The next 3 smashed his skull wide open. The rest of the blows were described as overkill. And according to Sir Bernard,
on the wall was a soft pinkish mess, which was later proved to be a piece of brain.
Only the violence inflicted upon George wasn't the most tragic part of his death. As Sir Bernard stated,
his body temperature showed that he hadn't died until at least 10 p.m. And with evidence of movement,
although his skull had been smashed in, unable to stand, speak, or even scream, George lay on the cold, hard floor behind a locked door, slowly dying. Paralyzed, bleeding, and terrified for at least 5 hours. Based on when William the Messenger had delivered the evening newspaper to George, and when he'd found the door to B77 locked, the detectives determined that the murder occurred during the 25-minute window of 4:50 p.m. and 5:15 p.m. Having locked the institute down, with no one allowed to leave, of the 6 inmates who had gone AWOL, 1 was dead, 4 had returned, but only 1 was missing. That day, on Friday the 26th of October, knowing that he read the lunchtime newspaper, the Standard published the following story on the front page. It read,
"Murder in London Hospital. George Hamblin was last seen at 5 o'clock last night. When discovered, police questioned the patients and the staff, and Scotland Yard were informed that one of the inmates was not on the premises."
And what followed in the article was a description of the hulking bulk of Jim Harvey. That same day, with a cleaner finding the bloodstained shirt behind the toilet of the Blue Hall Cinema in Edgware Road, police also discovered George's ready reckoner books and his tobacco pouch. And with the evidence mounting up, even more than usual, Jim was beginning to tremble and to sweat. Lying in bed, smoking heavily, and with the newspaper shaking in his nervous hands, Jim said to Clara,
"I want to tell you the truth. I'm not a bookie. I'm the man they want for the workhouse murder."
At which, even though he was the one with the chronic heart problems, it was Clara who fainted. Having convinced him to do the right thing, 7 hours after George's body was discovered, Jim walked into Paddington Green Police Station and gave himself up. But upon his arrest, when asked,
"Do you have anything to say?"
he replied,
"Do what you like. I know nothing about it."
The evidence against him was compelling. In his pockets, the police found George's wallet, a postal order for the day's horse races, and the key to the dugout. His fingerprints were found on the hammer, and George's blood group was found on the shirt, which he'd hidden, and his trousers, which he'd handed in, all of which were stitched with a laundry mark, B132, a unique number amongst the 1,300 inmates, which was given only to him. Making no confession, he refused to give an account of his whereabouts when George was killed. But with the money spent, the blackmail note missing, and it unexplained as to what 13, yes 13, actually meant. Bar a robbery, the murder was motiveless. Declared fit to stand trial, on Monday the 21st of January 1935, in a five-day trial at the Old Bailey. After just 1 hour, the jury found him guilty of murder. On the 11th of March 1935, at Pentonville Prison, George Frederick Harvey, also known as Jim, was executed by hanging. No family or friends had come to visit him, and with the only witnesses being the prison staff, his solicitor, and the hangman Robert Baxter, he died as he lived, alone. Jim Harvey took the real motive for the murder to his grave. And yet one detail remains a mystery. Why did he hide the fact that his real name was Charles Malcolm Lake Schoenberg? As even in his trial, he was referred to as George Harvey. Well, in some of the last words he ever spoke, he stated that, although he hadn't seen her in years,
"My mother is gravely ill, and I don't want to upset her."
He already had one death on his conscience, and with that shame enough to kill her, he couldn't bear another.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There we go. Oh, how long was that? Oh, a little bit longer than normal. Oh, waiting for lots of boats to go past. Oh, there we go. Oh, long day. Did a move of the boat this morning to move myself into a slightly better place, because it's my birthday weekend. So I wanted to be in a relatively nicer place for my birthday. So there we go. In somewhere nice and quiet. Nice and quiet, nice and peaceful. Although, really weird. I moored up and it was fine. It was nice there. And normally I don't moor up in front of benches. Because normally, especially in summer months, people come out and they sit by the benches and you think, oh no, it's going to be drunks and, you know, annoying. And I moored up and no one was there and it was fine. And then I looked out and there was like, do you know sometimes on true crime forums you get those very, very witty people who go, I've just seen a suitcase. Oh, there's a suitcase. Do you think there's a body in it? Maybe I watch too much true crime. Oh. So they all do it. It's really boring. Anyway, this was body shaped. This was a body shape covered in like an old bit of carpet or something like that. And I thought, oh, fuck. I wonder what it is. Double checked. Homeless person. There's a home. We're in the middle of nowhere and the homeless person on a really damp, boggy, horrible day and he's on a bench. So I've already been out. I've already contacted a little charity. So hopefully, I'm just keeping an eye out. So hopefully they're going to turn up or they might give me a call. I've sent them the coordinates of where he is. But they've said, you know, don't approach him because you don't know who he is and they'll come and deal with him. So hopefully in game. It looks like he's wearing kind of a charity blanket, one of those very grey ones. So it looks like he's already been through a charity, but is now kind of out and about. So let's hope he gets somewhere decent to sleep tonight, because you can't sleep in this weather and the rain is going to come down. So anyway, what else is going on? Oh, thank you to new Patreon supporters. So thank you to Kate Mee and Mary Cox. So thank you to Kate Mee and Mary Cox. Thank you for becoming Patreon supporters. Don't forget, as Patreon supporters, God, you get a lot of goodies. You get a lovely location video. This is for everyone. You get images that go with each episode to show you all the locations, and I go around and I film everything. Sometimes there's some unique stuff that I don't share anywhere else. I've started doing a thing called Bad Nanometers, which is for everyone. So when this episode goes out on the Thursday, that night you will get a kind of a nice, something like a witness statement. I'll read it entirely, or an autopsy report, or whatever's really interesting that didn't make it into the episode. So you get that. That's for everyone. And of course, the higher you go up the tier, the more kind of extra stuff you get, like early release episodes and, you know, lots of really cool stuff. So yeah, there you go. So I hope you're all enjoying those. What else is going on? That's it. I'm off to the Flicks tomorrow to watch a film with some friends. That'll be nice. Just a small group of friends, probably a meal. I'm getting too old to kind of go down the pub and get absolutely shitted. And then Sunday night we'll be doing a true crime roundtable with Adam and Paul and then Beth-Ann and Stu. So that'll be good. And we've got some interesting guests coming up as well. And I've got some guests who hopefully none of you have ever heard of. So that'll be really good as well. So let's... Oh, I can't remember if I said welcome to Extra Mile, the unscripted, unedited bit. We do some quiz stuff. And then I fill you in on some details that didn't make it into the episode. I don't think I really want a cup of tea at the moment. I've had like four or five because I was moving the boat today. I was going to move it just a little bit further down from here where there's no benches and no homeless people fast asleep. But it's too boggy. There's one place that's down there. It's just like I went out and checked the ground and it was so boggy. It's literally, I could see my boots sinking into it because we've had weeks of rain. So I moved here. Anyway, let's do some quiz questions and then I'm going to record all the other stuff I need to record. I might open a window because it's a bit stuffy, a little bit stuffy. Oh, I could do with a I haven't had a Diet Coke today. And I'm looking forward to tucking into my falafels, which are here. I've got some sweet potato pakora falafels. Are they falafels? I think they are. No, they're sweet potato pakoras. Hence they're called sweet potato pakoras, but I'm almost certain they're falafels. Can't beat some falafs. Some falafs or some crab fingers. Another boat going past. There we go. It's because it's a nice day today. It's good sunlight. When it's pissing down, people don't come out. When it's sunny, people come out. Anyway, I'm not bothered about the boat going past. I'm not going, oh, you bastard, I'm trying to record this. I'm on Extra Mile. Who cares? Who cares? Let's do the quiz questions. Let's see how many of them you get. Don't forget, I haven't edited the episode yet, so we'll see. I may take some of the references out, so you may not be able to answer the questions, but there we go. Question number one. The Westminster Institute had beds for how many men? So that's question number one. Don't forget this is an institute for men. They have institutes for women as well. This is in the era where, you know, men and women were separated according to institutes. I think also because it was a men's hospital as well. Women had their own hospital, so that's just how they did it. Question number two. How did Jim Harvey make his money? Question number three. How long had George Hamblin been in the institute? Question number four, Jim Harvey was born in what part of South London? South London, innit? Ooh, mate. Question number five, what height was Jim?
Jim.
Question number six, what illness did Jim contract in the Navy? Question number seven, what colour and pattern was the Institute's uniform? Question number eight, what was the name of the superintendent who George Hamblin was the valet to? Question number nine, what is the fuel which powers Britain? According to what I said in this episode. And question number ten, what block did they live and work in? So let's dive into some extra stuff. So George Frederick Harvey, in the press, as always, the press always get things wrong. They call him George Frank Harvey, although, as we know, that's not his name. 37 years old, was a former chef in the Merchant Navy. Merchant Navy is the ones, they move all the shipping, they move all the stuff around. His real name was Charles Malcolm Lake Schoenberg, born on the 6th of April 1908. So he was 27 when he died. Yeah, 27 when he died. Even though in the press they seem to list him as 37. He wasn't. He was 27. What else we got? We've already done that. We've already done the bit about his mum. I thought I'd save that to the end because it always leaves a kind of a thing in the air where you go, oh, he's using a fake name. Is it, you know, Schoenberg? You think Schoenberg. Oh, you know, he's probably German or something. Oh, and this is around World War One. Oh, he's probably a spy or something. No, he just didn't want to upset his mum. He was already kind of... We don't know a lot about his life, and we don't know why, throughout most of his life, he was going by George Harvey and Jim Harvey as well. Whether he was running away from home, whether he didn't want anything to do with his family, whether this was an anti-German thing, we don't know, because there was a lot of... Do you know, you got the kind of the rise of the fascists in around the kind of the 1920s and 1930s, so that could have been something, hence he may have just decided to go with George Harvey just to make his life a little bit better. So we don't know anything about that. There really was nothing in the files at all, really, about their lives, so this is just stuff that I've been able to pick up. He was a tall man, that's one of the quiz questions. Round face, medium build, a slight stoop, clean shaven, and dark hair brushed back. Early life, his maternal aunt and uncle committed suicide by gas poisoning. Apparently his maternal aunt did it because she was barren, i.e. she couldn't have any children, and that was a couple of years ago. His family apparently were all heavy drinkers, all had a history of rheumatic fever. As did he as a child. His father was ultimately interviewed and said as a baby he suffered from infantile convulsions and that from the age of three he has not been responsible for his actions. His father said as a tot he ran away and they could not find him for days. He has not been home much since he was about 8 years old, and until the murder his father hadn't seen him for about 4 or 5 years. Digging a little bit deeper, where was it? So he had several brothers. He had Frank, Eileen, Marjorie, Horatio, and James. And Charles was the... Charles, don't forget, that is Jim Harvey. He's the oldest out of all of them. Oldest by about 2 years. His father, Thomas James Lake Schoenberg, born in St. Pancras. And his mother, Florence Emily Molyneux, also born in South London as well. His mother was described as an invalid, a sickly woman, and he was greatly worried about her. interesting that they seem to be not middle class, but kind of lower middle class. Lived in a kind of relatively good area. He's not massively impoverished. He doesn't seem to have much of an education, but I think half of that is because he kind of ran away from home a lot. Was a chef in the merchant navy, as mentioned, where he joined from age 17 to 19. Is that a quiz question? I can't remember if it's a quiz question of what he contracted, but he contracted something, there we go, which left him breathless. Never married, never had children. So this is why this kind of thing is set up, because with a lot of women, if kind of things are going bad for them, they can go back to their families, because you know, this is an era where a woman has to be provided for by a man, and if she hasn't got a man, then she goes back to live with her family. But this is kind of an era where if a man isn't married and doesn't have kids, he'll just, you know, they'll just go, well, you know, you're a man, just go and sort it out. So unfortunately, that's kind of what happened to him. We don't really know a lot about his past either, so there could have been a lot of problems going on. 3rd of March 1921, when he was 13 years old, at Southwestern Police Court, he was charged with stealing money and was sent to an industrial school. So that's kind of like a borstal. 8th of September 1924, age 17, same place. He was charged with stealing a watch chain, again sent back to an industrial school. 30th of June 1928, age 21, at Bodmin. So that's west of the country, southwest, south, never eat shredded wheat, southwest. He was charged with stealing money, and because he was an adult by then, 21 years old, he was sent to prison for 2 years. So that would be after he was released from the Navy, the Merchant Navy. 22nd of October 1929, aged 22, a West London police court. He was charged with stealing earrings and sent to 6 months in prison. 1932, aged 25, he entered the institution. So he's quite young, really, when he enters the institution. Originally, he was on and off there for about 2 years. He kept it secret from his family. Various sicknesses, including the one which is a quiz question, as well as asthma. He'd been into several hospitals throughout short periods. Don't forget, this is the wonderful National Health Service was created in late 1940s, early 1950s. But because this is 1930s, we're still in that horrible era where, you know, if you were sick, you could only get well if you could afford to get well. If you were poor, you were basically screwed. Are you paying attention, America? So kind of a really difficult time for him. So, you know, he's got loads of illnesses coming on. I think the main one he had from when he was in the Navy really kind of exacerbated everything, especially his childhood illnesses as well. So he had influenza as well, lumbago, Baker's dermatitis. He's fainting a lot because he has heart trouble. They said he had vascular disease of the heart. He was prone to breathlessness, heavy sweating. Hence, which is why it's kind of interesting. I think anyone else who was seen leaving a murder scene, like sweating and profusely panting and stuff like that, people would go, oh, you look suspicious. But because everyone there knew that he was a big guy and he sweated a lot and he was always out of breath, they just took it as read that's what he did. He denies that he ever had epilepsy, that he has any mental illness, memory loss, or wanderings, as they call it. In 1925, 27, and 29, he was placed in various institutions in London. He said he had no mental aberrations, or none were seen while he was there. And when he's in interview, he's described as rational and normal, is the words they used. What have we got? I was going to do some stuff in the episode about the attendants, because obviously there's loads of attendants there who kind of saw what he was doing around that time. George William James, who was the leave ward attendant, said that at 5:15 p.m. on the 25th, Harvey handed in his institution clothing. He was agitated and sweating. Asked why he was in a hurry, he replied, "It has been a terrible hurry," which is a great excuse for why are you in a hurry. It has been a terrible hurry. The ward attendant examined the clothing. He saw, don't forget, this is the trousers and the cap and things like that. And he saw the identification number B132, which was Jim Harvey's number, which matches his clothes. You know, that's what they do. But when he looked up, Harvey was gone. He said, I noticed the shirt was missing. This would be the bloodstained shirt, so he had it on under his suit, as mentioned. What else have we got? Even though this is why I tried to get it across at the start of the episode, where we're saying there's not really... The institution it's not like a prison, it's not like a workhouse, it's not kind of a bad place. It's kind of, you know, they know that most of the people here are kind of sick and infirm, and it's not really a hospital, it's just kind of a halfway house, really. So they kind of, they're quite light with them, really. So there's security, but there's no real security. What they're just trying to do is keep an eye on who's in there, why they're in there, and, you know, if they disappear, it's not a problem, because they'll probably come back, because they're homeless and they haven't got any money and they haven't got any food. Therefore, this isn't a prison, it's kind of a place which gives them what they need in order to stay alive. So not a great place, but for some people it's all that they've got. So escaping wasn't really a problem. There were leave passes that were on the table. Some people say that there were leave passes on George's table, i.e. in the dugout, but we don't really have any confirmation of that. And therefore, because he was able to get a leave pass, therefore he could get his clothes back. So what normally happens is you wave your leave pass and it says what time you're allowed to leave, and then someone will give you back your clothes, and you change into your clothes, you put them in a bag, and then you give them to the leave ward attendant as you're leaving. So there we go. What else we got? William Richardson. So we pretty much wouldn't know much about what was going on without William Richardson, who was the messenger. So William Richardson was just an inmate, but because everyone was kind of given jobs, you either had jobs like as you would in the prison, like working in the laundry or working in the mess hall. But because these guys were kind of, you know, quite infirm, they were given kind of the more menial jobs, like being a valet. You know, that's quite light jobs, really, and privileged jobs as well. William Richardson was basically just an unofficial messenger to George. Really, he was kind of really a helper to George, but he became the messenger for the whole betting system. Even though the superintendents knew about it, it wasn't a bad thing. It's the kind of thing like they do in prison, you know. You're not really meant to bring contraband into prison, but, you know, they're not really going to kick up a fuss if it's chocolate or tea bags or something like that. If it's drugs, they will, but or blades. But if it's something like that, they're not really that bothered. You know it's going to happen, so you need to let certain amounts of things that are contraband in and not stop everything. Otherwise, the place just erupts into chaos. So you kind of let little things in, and that's what they were doing here. They weren't that bothered, you know. These people didn't have money. They were only betting on like a penny. A penny or a tuppence was the average bet. And that, you know, it's not a hell of a lot of money. And as they were only betting once a day, wasn't really a problem. So it's only when it became a problem that they stamped down on it. So William Richardson came back to it. The timings vary. It seems to be around 5:15, 5:20, but that's about right. Don't forget, this is an era where people still aren't using watches or wristwatches. So, you know, it's hard to really pin stuff down. The reason we know that is because we know that they all went and had their dinner at 5 p.m. exactly, because there was a 5-minute bell just before, and then there was a 5 p.m. bell that said dinner time, come in and get your stuff. And that was for that particular block. What else was there? William Richardson. So he searched various rooms that day. He searched the day rooms and the mess hall and places like that. Not because people were looking for their winnings, because they knew they'd get their winnings eventually that evening. There was no real rush. But because George Hamblin had actually asked William Richardson to get him some tobacco while he was out. So he'd returned with some Lights Returns or Faulkner's Special Nosegay. So that's the brands of tobacco that he liked. But yeah, he got it for him, and then there was no sign of George Hamblin at all. That night, they realised that his bed was empty. Albert Poole did the bed checks between 10:30 p.m. and 10:41 p.m. That's when he was in room B63, and he looked at bed 3, which was usually occupied by George Hamblin, and that was empty. He also did another check at 7:05 a.m. and saw that it was empty. And because
There were only two keys to the dugout, and one of them, obviously, I've forgotten his name for a second. Jim Harvey. Jesus Christ. Because Jim Harvey had taken the spare key with him, which is interesting. When I was going through the archive files, do you know, there's really fascinating things that you see in the archive files. So this is a slight deviation. With the Blackout Ripper, there was the original laundry markers in there. So it was... that they put on the clothes, and that's how they I think that was for Evelyn Hamilton, was the laundry markers. In this case, I opened up the file, and in there was the original door key. So I took a photo of that. So that's in with the patron stuff. Fascinating. You just open up the file and it's like, oh, there's a key there. And then when I read the file, I was like, oh shit, that is the original key. So that was fascinating. In one case that I know of, there was some flayed flesh was in there. Lovely. It's amazing what you find in there. There really is. Sometimes there's nothing, sometimes there's dull stuff, but sometimes you find original evidence and you go, oh, it's fascinating. Sometimes you open up the file and there's a little thing in there that says original evidence in here, and you open it up and it's empty because someone has snaffled it. Utter bastards. What else we got? Six men went AWOL that night. The four of them disappeared, but they came back the next day, not because they heard about the murder, but because, you know, it's what they did. They went out, they had some fun, they came back, they said, we're really sorry about that. Because the punishment for going AWOL, it's not like you're going to get, like, oh, you're going to get 6 months on your sentence. Basically, they were like, right, you're not going to get a dessert for like two nights. And, you know, your tobacco rations, we're going to cut that by half. And it's they can't really do a lot. They can't stop people leaving, but they know they're going to come back. So it's not a real problem. What else was there? What else was there? I think that might be it. I don't want to do too much. I think that might be it. Only because I've got a lot to power through today, and also I want to go to the shops and get some food. I'm not going to make my usual kebabs tonight because it's my birthday in 2 days. Whoopee effing do! I want to treat myself to something nice, I think, and then come back and watch a really good finish the documentary on the Columbia disaster, the Columbia shuttle disaster. I'm partway through that, so I want to finish that. So there we go. And Gladiators. Weird. I'm watching the new series of Gladiators, which I used to enjoy as a kid, and I thought, oh, they remade it. Oh, it's going to be shit. And it's really good, actually. It's really good because, you know what? They've looked at it and clearly gone, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So they literally haven't done anything. They've just taken all the elements and they've gone, well, this all works, and 99% of it works, so we'll just redo all that. They've zhuzhed it up where they need to. They've obviously taken out the slightly racist names of the black gladiators, who are all called Dark Shade or Night Terror or shit like that. And it's quite good, and it's quite tense as well, which I quite like. You're watching it and you know it's just a game, but it's quite tense, so I'm quite enjoying that. So I think that's it. I think, yeah. It was nice. Inside the files as well were some of the betting slips as well. So one guy had put 3p on a horse called Private Present, another 3p on Nurant, another one 3p on Chelsea Reach, one on Lee's Head, and another one on Adventures. Ooh, these are all the names of the horses that were racing that day. Walter Blanchett, who mentioned it. I wonder if he's related to Kate Blanchett. I hope he even didn't hear that. Walter Blanchett, because he didn't have any money on him, his sister, Mary, I don't know why I said Sally, her name was Mary, because he had a sister who was kind of helping him out, she gave him a postal order. And don't forget, postal orders don't exist anymore, but they used to be the thing where if you wanted to send money to someone, you could do it through a postal order, and you could do it for a certain amount of money. And she'd given him a postal order for 1 shilling and 6p. But instead of spending it on food, he decided to put it on a horse called Argyle, which lost. So there you go. What else? I think that's pretty much it. I don't want to go into too much. Yeah, I think I'm done on that one. So anyway, hope you enjoyed that episode. Another kind of one-off one One from the past. It's interesting, isn't it? I had to keep rethinking when I was doing this, because it feels like an episode that's 1880s, 1890s, like that, but it's not. It's 1930s. And this is kind of the era when, like, workhouses are starting to be phased out by this point. Also, the mention in there of the hammer, so it was a lump hammer used to break up rocks. The reason why he had access to it is breaking of rocks used to be a job that would happen in the workhouses, but not in the 1930s. They'd phased it out by that point. That was one of the punishments that they went, that's too cruel, we're not going to do that. But they still had lump hammers in the building, so it wasn't being used, and hence he was able to use it. But as you can see, it's a formidable weapon. Like, in the press, they just said a hammer. But looking at the crime scene photos, and when you look at the dimensions of it was like, over the handle was about 2 foot long, the head itself was about 2 kilos. You know, this is big and heavy and used to break up rocks. I did a little bit of science on it, and they said, you know, it takes a ton of pressure in order to impact the brain, or to deform the skull by 1 centimeter. So you can, given the fact that he caved in the skull, you can really see how this was a really violent and horrible attack, especially as 9 hits as well. He held him down on the table and then 9 hits. It's pretty horrible. No defensive wounds as well. So let's do some quiz questions, and then I can continue doing what I need to do. So I hope you enjoy that. Question number one. The Westminster Institute had beds for how many men?
Oh, I've got burpees.
1,300. Question number two. How did Jim Harvey make his money? By selling illegal cups of tea. So because everyone had a ration of how many cups of tea they could have per day, he was selling good cups of tea, but also stronger versions of cups of tea. Question number three. How long? I mean, he was making 90 quid a day. So do you know what? Hats off to him. Question number three. How long had George Hamblin been in the Institute? He'd been there 14 years. So if you said 12 or 13 or 14, I'll give you that. Or even 15. Oh, fuck it. Everyone can have a free point for that one. Who cares? Question number four. Jim Harvey was born in what part of South London? It was Balham. But I used to live as a many, many years ago. Question number five. The last place I lived before I became a boater. Question number five. What height was Jim? He was 6'2", which, let's not forget, in and around that era, the average man was around 5'7", so he was very tall. I mean, that is tall, but he's very tall. Question number six. What illness did Jim contract in the Navy? He had malaria. Question number seven, what colour was the Institute's uniform? Oh, and what pattern, colour and pattern, was the Institute's uniform? It was blue and striped. Question number eight, what was the name of the superintendent who George Hamblin was the valet to? I think I may have given that away. It was Harry Pocock. Harry Pocock? And question number nine, what is the fuel which powers Britain? I mean, there's three, obviously. One is cake, two is Eva. But the answer to this one is tea. And question number 10, what block did they live on? That's an easy one, isn't it? It's B block. So that's it, folks. Hope you all enjoyed that. Next week, we've got another one-parter. I'm not too sure which one I'm doing. I think it might be a contemporary one. I think it might be a potential serial killer that no one seems to talk about. But there we go. So I hope you all enjoyed that. Have yourself a good week, folks. Stay safe and be good. And thank you very much for supporting the show. It's very much appreciated. Have yourself a good one. Lots of love, everyone. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.